welcome to the very first of the Darwin Lectures, a Royal Society lecture series on evolution in collaboration with Radio New Zealand National. I'm Phil Smith. It's about 150 years ago that Darwin's idea of natural selection became public. And in this lecture series, some of New Zealand's most distinguished thinkers will outline the basics of this huge change in how we see ourselves and our planet. Today, we're in Napier, where Lloyd Spencer Davis will kick off the series with the evolution of Darwin's big idea. There are an unfeasibly large number of misconceptions about natural selection. It seems that everyone knows of it, and few know about it. Almost as a proof of the theory itself, innocuous misunderstandings mutate into confusions, which mutate into fears, and even into rabid furies, and the evolution of myth always keeps just ahead of attempts to explain the facts, with the most scandalous ideas the most well-adapted to survive in the harsh world of hearsay. Now, hopefully, some of them will be nailed down and hit over the head by the speakers in the series, but there are a few that they will likely not broach. So let me take a moment now to shoot one or two of the elephants in the room. And first up, the biggie, God. Natural selection, and for that matter, any other branch of science, says absolutely nothing at all about the existence, or otherwise, of a God. Religious texts are about man's relationship with God. Science is not, and vice versa. The Bible isn't terribly specific about the science of creation. I mean, about why a creator would opt for symmetry or gravity or what the speed of light is and why. These things aren't mentioned. They don't impact on that faith relationship, and nor should evolution. Even if it wanted to, science doesn't have the ability to theorize about God. Real science is built of theories that can be disproved, and it is utterly impossible to disprove the existence of God. God is just not something science is equipped to discuss. Yes, scientists do have opinions about God. Some believe, some do not. But when anyone confuses physics with theology, they do both a disservice. So, God and evolution are not mutually exclusive. The Bible is full of beautiful metaphor, and it leaves a comfy amount of room open for interpretation. While we're at it, a few more quick points. Evolution is not a theory, just as gravity is not a theory. They are both observed facts. But Darwin's idea of natural selection is a theory, as are Newton's and Einstein's laws of gravity. Evolution is what we observe. Natural selection is an explanation of that observation. All explanatory ideas in science are theories because explanations remain open for improvement or indeed replacement. Yes, there are transitional fossils. Alan Cooper will go a little bit into that in the fourth lecture. Survival of the fittest does not mean the most able to do sit-ups, or the strongest, or indeed the most vicious. It means, almost tautologically, that the organism that copes the best copes the best. Nothing survives like survival. It also doesn't mean everyone for themselves, although Darwin did struggle with the idea of altruism. As Russell Gray and Brian Boyd will tell us later in this series, cooperation, society, being nice, and even believing stuff in groups, and yes, that includes religion, are often very useful to survival. And lastly, natural selection isn't random, not vaguely. Mutation, that's random. Selection is based on fit. As Dawkins says, and as Paul Rainey will remind us in the second lecture, natural selection is the non-random selection of randomly generated variations. Okay, enough already. Let me introduce today's lecturer. Lloyd Spencer Davis was born right here in Napier. Enamoured with the likes of Jacques Cousteau and David Attenborough, he dreamed of a career in biology from an early age. He initially studied at Victoria University, becoming interested in the evolution of animal behaviour, and then, to more easily get to Antarctica, he moved to Canterbury, before finishing a PhD in Canada on the behaviour of ground squirrels, not something that's very easy to study in Hagley Park. During that time, Lloyd Spencer Davis began moving into science communication. From here, through the windows, you can see Cape Kidnappers, where Lloyd made his first nature movie, predictably enough on gannets. Moving to Dunedin, he hooked up with the Natural History Science Unit down there and really hasn't stopped since. These days, it's more books than films. Lloyd won the Children's Book Award for a book on penguins and was the runner-up in a travel writing prize this year with a book on tonight's subject, Charles Darwin. Ladies and gentlemen, please with me welcome the inaugural Stuart Professor of Science Communication at the University of Otago, Professor Lloyd Spencer Davis.
Thank you, Phil. In the last 2,000 years, there has been one idea above all else which has altered the way we view the world and our place in it. That idea is evolution by natural selection, and the originator of that idea was Charles Darwin. And what distinguishes Darwin's contribution from the myriad other advances in knowledge over that period is that it fundamentally changed our perception of who we are. From the ultimate products of a supernatural creator to the incidental byproducts of a natural process. So I would take some disagreement, if you like, with Phil in that I think that evolution and natural selection in particular does have something to say about creation anyway, at least the creation story. It doesn't conflict with God necessarily, but you have to put it in context that the story of creation that was being told at the time was one propounded by the church. Charles Darwin was born on 12th February 1809. He first presented his ideas to the rarefied world of academia on 1st July 1858 in a joint presentation given on behalf of himself and Alfred Russel Wallace to the Linnaean Society in London. And a year later, he unleashed it on the world at large in the form of his book On the Origin of Species. And yet, even today, as we celebrate the 150th anniversary of the birth of his idea and approach the 200th anniversary of his own birth, many of us know little more of Darwin other than his name. Few of us, it seems, are really familiar with the workings of his idea of evolution. The great geneticist Theodor Dobzhansky once said, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in light of evolution." However, when I survey the classes of undergraduates I teach, these are biologists in the making, it is rare to find even 1% who have read On the Origin of Species. If these would-be biologists don't refer to what is essentially biology's Bible, why should we care? Why should you care about Darwin and his idea? Today I will do two things. First, I will recount the various strands that led Darwin inextricably to a conclusion that flew in the face of the prevailing creation story propounded by the church. I'll talk about the evolution of his idea, if you like. And second, I will attempt to demonstrate briefly how even after 150 years, you really should care about Darwin's idea. Much of the material for today's talk comes from the research and writing of my book, Looking for Darwin, which, as the cover line says, seeks the truth about God and evolution. And as with the book, when attempting to unravel the various influences on Darwin's life, it seems best to start with his family. You see, the Darwins were larger than life in every possible way. His grandfather Erasmus and his father Robert were big blighters for a start off. One has only to look at portraits of the men to realize that they had the height of a John Olomou and the girth of a David Longy before he had his stomach stapled. Robert stood 6 foot 2 inches tall and stopped weighing himself when he got to 336 pounds, after which, according to Charles Darwin, he got a lot bigger. Charles himself stood 6 foot tall, and although he never attained the round proportions of his paternal lineage, you have to nevertheless put this in perspective. The average height in Britain at the time for males was 5 foot 5 inches. So Charles and his family were bound to stand out in any crowd, no matter what their ideas. But they had big ideas too. Erasmus Darwin was a physician, and during the late 18th century, he was also one of Britain's foremost poets. He was a member of the Lunar Society, a group of movers and shakers around Birmingham, so called because they met when the moon was full to avoid the likelihood of being attacked by highway robbers when travelling to and from the meetings. Here, Erasmus met and mixed with the likes of James Watt, he who invented the steam engine, and Joseph Priestley, he who discovered oxygen. And the Lunar Society was in many ways the nursery ground for industry, chemistry, and medicine in 18th century England. And from Erasmus, at least, came also the whisperings of such new and daring ideas as evolution. In his two-volume poem, Zoonomia, Erasmus set out the concept of evolution, whereby species, he argued, could change from one to another. There is a misconception among many people that it was Charles Darwin who first proposed the idea of evolution. It most certainly was not. But while his grandfather and others may have had that heretical notion before him, that species were not the immutable creations of God, what distinguished Charles Darwin's version of the idea was that he provided a mechanism by which it could occur. So Charles Darwin's great triumph was not to come up with the idea of evolution per se, but to show how it could work. So while his grandfather's view of evolution was more whimsy than workable, nevertheless, it was Charles Darwin's great fortune to be born into a family where such concepts were even discussed. It was a family very much open to observation of the natural world. Indeed, Erasmus' brother John was a botanist, and he wrote a seminal text on botany, which was still used to classify plants even in Charles Darwin's day. And Robert Darwin, Charles's father, while being a physician like Erasmus, was also a lover of exotic plants, and he bred them and kept observations on them in his extensive gardens. Evolution, as it turned out, was by no means Erasmus' sole interest. Elsewhere in Zoonomia, he wrote, "Wine, woman, warmth, against our lives combine. But what is life without warmth, woman, wine?" Sentiments I find it hard to disagree with. And despite a face pockmarked by the after effects of smallpox and a pronounced stammer, it seems that Erasmus was seldom without all three. He fathered 14 children, 5 by his first marriage, 7 by the second, and 2 by his mistress when between wives. Another of Erasmus' contemporaries at the Lunar Society was his good friend, Josiah Wedgwood, founder of the Pottery Dynasty. And the Wedgwoods and the Darwins became like factories producing spouses for each other. Josiah, as was more acceptable then, had married his cousin, and they'd had 7 children. It would be their eldest daughter, Susanna, who in 1796 would marry Erasmus' son, Robert, and set about having 6 children of their own, the 5th born being Charles Robert Darwin, born on 12th February 1809. Charles was born in the bedroom of the Mount, a large house that Robert and Susanna Darwin built on the outskirts of Shrewsbury, from where the good doctor ran his practice. When I visited the Mount in 2003, I was surprised to find that it was the home of the Shrewsbury Valuation Office, and in fact it still is today. To the left of the entrance was the waiting room for Dr. Darwin's surgery. down the corridor, the surgery itself, and across the passage, the servants' quarters. For while the Darwins were not ostentatious with their wealth, Dr. Robert Darwin was a shrewd investor. And as we shall see, it was also Charles Darwin's great fortune to be born into a family that could support his subsequent intellectual pursuits. Although there was precious little evidence of that when I was there on my visit. Upstairs, the valuation office used the bedroom in which Charles Darwin was born as a dumping ground for discarded computers. It seems incomprehensible to me that what should be a shrine to the birthplace of such a great thinker should be so casually disregarded. Perhaps in part a consequence of the incest that was so rife in their family, many of the Wedgwoods were prone to illness. And Darwin's mother, Susanna, died when he was only 8. At 9, Charles Darwin was then sent away to the Shrewsbury School with his older brother, named Erasmus after their grandfather, despite the fact that the school, which is now in the Shrewsbury Public Library, was only 15 minutes' walk from the Mount. Its headmaster was a Dr. Samuel Butler, a man prone to the classics and to beating the boys. Although, to give him his dues, he said that he rarely beat the same boy twice in 1 week. Which actually sounded an awful lot like my experience going to school here at Napier Boys High, where I saw enough of the cane to realize that corporal punishment was no way to engender school spirit. And as Darwin put it, nothing could have been worse for the development of my mind than Dr. Butler's school. While his early schooling may not have been much help to Darwin's subsequent development of his idea, what happened next was. And how excited Darwin must have been then when his father took him out of school at the tender age of 16 and shipped him up to Edinburgh with his brother Erasmus to study medicine. It would be fair to say that Darwin did not exactly take to medicine. This was a time before the use of anesthetics, such as chloroform, and it seemed that one operation he witnessed involved a child and an amputation. And Darwin ran from the theatre before the operation was complete, and the screams of that child and the sight of that blood, he would say later, would haunt him forevermore. The liberating effect of this was that Darwin, no longer concerned with medicine as a career, started to pick and choose the lectures he attended. He joined a group called the Plinian Society, which met regularly to read papers in natural history. And particularly through a Plinian friend, Robert Grant, he was exposed to rebellious views on religious ideology. Views such as Lamarck's that, like those of Darwin's grandfather, challenged the immutability of species. If you think that caused Darwin to shy away from the church, think again. After a couple of years in Edinburgh, Darwin decided to go to Cambridge University to study for the clergy. He reasoned that he could indulge his passion for natural history, which principally involved collecting beetles, between ministering to his flock. At Cambridge, Darwin became close to the cleric and botanist, the Reverend John Stevens Henslow, often accompanying him on his daily walks. This caused Darwin to be known as the man who walks with Henslow. And at Henslow's urging, Darwin accompanied Professor Adam Sedgwick to Wales, where he learnt about geology, an interest and skill that would be crucial to the development of Darwin's subsequent ideas and thoughts on evolution. So there you had it, the happy coincidence of events and circumstance. From his family to his education, they were now all in place. And these set Darwin up with the requisite attributes to take advantage of an opportunity that would be given to him. But here again, he was really lucky. In 1828, the captain of a small coastal ship surveying Tierra del Fuego, unable to cope with the frightful weather and the desolate landscape, shot himself with a pistol. And at the ripe old age of 23 then, a brilliant young aristocratic graduate of the Royal Navy College, Robert Fitzroy, found himself promoted to the role of commander of His Majesty's sloop Beagle. When asked to go back to Tierra del Fuego to continue the mapping, and perhaps conscious of the toll that such loneliness had taken on his predecessor, Fitzroy determined that he needed a companion, a gentleman, to accompany him. Henslow briefly considered the job for himself, because Henslow was actually only 35, and then offered the position to one of Darwin's fellow students, Leonard Jennings. But he too turned it down, and eventually Henslow recommended Darwin as an agreeable companion first, and a competent enough naturalist second. Darwin's secondment to the HMS Beagle as naturalist suggests something that it was not: gainful employment. In fact, the Admiralty expected Darwin to pay for himself during the expedition, which in effect meant that his father, Dr. Robert Darwin, had to foot the bill along with £600 of expenses even before the ship left the dock. A considerable sum in those days. And again, the wealth of the Darwins should not be underestimated as being a vital component necessary for the development of Charles Darwin's idea. So it was that on 27th December 1831, Charles Darwin set sail from Plymouth aboard the Beagle on a journey that would change not just him, but our understanding of the world. Throughout the entire expedition, which lasted nearly 5 years, Darwin would look in vain for his sea legs. He would be as sick on the final leg as he had been during those dreadful moments encountered soon after leaving Plymouth. "I hate every wave of the ocean," he wrote. Fortunately for us, despite the extreme discomfort, he hung in there. And on 29th February 1832, the Beagle arrived in South America, where it proceeded to sail up and down the coast, mapping it, with Darwin often going ashore for long periods to collect specimens and to no doubt recuperate. In September 1832, aboard the Beagle, once again, Fitzroy asked Darwin whether the bones they could see sticking out of the gravel at the foot of reddish cliffs on the Argentine coast, whether they could be fossils. Indeed, they had hit the mother lode, the deathbeds of animals from another time, if not another place. Working around the clock, Darwin retrieved bones, many of them, as he said, of great size. He recognized the bones of Megatherium, a giant sloth. There were others he did not recognize, a giant armadillo, and a giant guanaco that stood as big as a camel. There were bones from another huge sloth, Glyptodon, and Toxodon, an enormous version of the capybara. And more than anything, it was not that these were extinct fossils that captured Darwin's imagination, nor even their immense size. It was that given both of these features, these fossils should all be so clearly similar to existing animals, albeit smaller ones, that still roamed around the South American landscape. If the Great Flood had come, as the devout Fitzroy insisted, and these fossilized animals had simply been too big or too slow to get aboard Noah's Ark, while that might explain their being extinct, it couldn't explain why there should be modern forms of those same animals still around. Could it be that the large extinct forms had begat the smaller modern ones? By 1834, Darwin took another step in terms of his thinking when he got to climb in the Andes on the Chilean side of South America. There he made an amazing discovery. At 12,000 feet, he found fossil shells, and a little further down, fossilized trees in what was clearly marine sediment. Fitzroy's reaction had been, "Huh, so what? The mountains had always been there. The fossils were the result of the Great Flood." But Darwin was by now armed with the volumes of Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology, which had been sent out to him in South America. As Janet Brown, our foremost Darwin scholar, says, Lyell's book taught Darwin how to think about nature. Without Lyell, there would have been no Darwin, no intellectual journey, no voyage of the Beagle as commonly understood. For Lyell maintained that the Earth was a lot older than had previously been believed. And to Darwin, the Those fossil shells at 12,000 feet confirmed it. They said that, as difficult as it may be to accept, the crust of the earth was a changing beast that could rise and fall. What was forest could end up in the seas, and what were oysters clinging to an underwater life could end up on the tops of mountains, all given enough time. Fortuitously for Darwin's developing ideas, but not so fortuitously for the Chilean people, the earth itself would move for Darwin. On 20th February 1835, there was an earthquake, which according to Darwin lasted 2 minutes, but appeared much longer. Its epicenter was close to the city of Concepcion. Fitzroy and Darwin rode into Concepcion to find it completely leveled. Apart from the devastation, the most significant thing Darwin noticed was that the land around Concepcion's harbour appeared to have risen. Spending several days making measurements, Darwin concluded that the earthquake had raised the land about 8 feet. And if it could rise at 8 feet, why not 8,000 feet or more? Why couldn't the Andes have arisen from the seas, taking with them the seashells like those he had observed around Concepcion that had been lifted above the high tide mark? As Darwin wrote, "To my mind, since leaving England, we have scarcely beheld any one other sight so deeply interesting." Darwin, you see, was starting to accept that the earth was fluid, flexible. Over time, even continents could change. And if continents could change, then why not the animals and plants on them? The Galapagos Islands would prove crucial to Darwin's realization that species are not immutable, but have evolved from one to the other. Given their importance in the development of Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, it comes as a surprise that Darwin spent only a month there during a journey of nearly 5 years. The best estimates are that the Galapagos rose out of the ocean no more than 5 million years ago, a blink of the eye in geologic time. So if the Galapagos Islands are so new, where did all the animals and plants that populate them come from? And this is where all Fitzroy's and Darwin's mucking around South America over the previous 4 years really paid dividends. If someone were organizing a trip now to go around the world with the express purpose of discovering evidence for natural selection, they might be tempted to hightail it to the Galapagos and set up camp. But it was really Darwin's intimate familiarity with the South American flora and fauna that allowed him to see links that others would have missed. The Galapagos Islands were undeniably young, yet most of the animals and plants were new species, peculiar only to the Galapagos. But it got curiouser and curiouser. Darwin realized that despite having so many species peculiar to it, the creatures and plants of the Galapagos had similar counterparts on the South American mainland. The most likely scenario was the representatives of the South America flora and fauna had somehow been transported to the newly emerged islands by wind, by sea, storm, or driftwood, and once there had become modified to new forms. But how and why? As Darwin himself put it, "Both in space and time, we seem to be brought somewhat near to that great fact, that mystery of mysteries, the first appearance of new beings on Earth." The clue to solving this mystery would actually come not from examining the origins of the animals and plants that arrived in the Galapagos, but their fate once they got there. This is where the Galapagos Islands really came up trumps and why they are so crucial to Darwin's view of the world. For Darwin's great stroke of fortune was to realize eventually that within the Galapagos archipelago, each island had a different suite of animals and plants, even though they existed under roughly the same conditions and circumstances. As he wrote, "I never dreamed that islands about 50 or 60 miles apart and most of them in sight of each other formed of precisely the same rocks, placed under a quite similar climate, rising to a nearly equal height, would have been so differently tenanted. Darwin was initially clued into this fact by the vice-governor of the colony, Mr. Nicholas Lawson, who told Darwin that he could tell what island a tortoise came from simply by looking at its shell. But it was only later, when on board the Beagle after they had set sail from the Galapagos, that Darwin recalled the remark and recognized its significance. The three species of mocking thrushes he had collected each came from different islands. The penny dropped. He started to think about his collection of finches, of which he had many species and which he had already marveled at the great variety and gradation in their bill shapes and sizes. From the pattern he observed, where he did know something of the island source, and he didn't always know that, he concluded that he had strong reasons to suspect that at least some species of the finches are confined to separate islands. And so, catching the same train of thought as Darwin, we might suppose that immigrants from the South American continent had somehow arrived in the Galapagos archipelago, and as they occupied each island, over time they became modified. Hence, for evolution to occur, it seemed that a necessary prerequisite must involve some form of isolation, at least reproductive isolation, separate breeding groups, as it were, which in effect each island provided. And then some process must have altered the design of the animals to fit the peculiarities of their specific lifestyle on their specific island. But what process? From the Galapagos Islands, the Beagle headed to Tahiti, then on to New Zealand, arriving in the Bay of Islands on 21st December 1835. It's fair to say that Darwin did not exactly like New Zealand. And after 9 days, the Beagle set sail for Australia. And Darwin's parting words were, "I believe we were all glad to leave New Zealand. It is not a pleasant place." The Beagle finally arrived back in England on 2nd October 1836. After 4 years, 10 months, and 6 days, the voyage of the Beagle was over, something that Darwin would later describe in his autobiography as by far the most important event in my life. Darwin was a changed man, but it would be a mistake to presume that he was a rabid evolutionist at this time. True, he no longer wished for a career in the clergy and hoped that he could make a worthwhile contribution to science. However, he had not renounced God, for while the voyage of the Beagle undoubtedly altered Darwin, there was no one eureka moment, no one event that unequivocally shouted at Darwin that he should replace a world created by God with one created by evolution. Back in England, Darwin at first busied himself with the task of having his collections described, rather than the lofty questions they inspired. But in 1837, some months after the Beagle's return, Darwin began to think seriously of the transmutation of species. And in July of that year, he began his first private notebook on the subject. There is a perception among the public, indeed biologists too, that Darwin arrived back from his voyage and then dilly-dallied for over 20 years before being spurred into writing about the origin of species by Alfred Russel Wallace, independently deriving the concept of natural selection. The impression that is given is that Darwin was something of a lazy bastard, living off his father's wealth, not required to earn a living, and free to potter about somewhat aimlessly on topics that took his fancy. That could not be further from the truth. Charles Darwin was nothing if not prolific when it came to be a scientist and a writer. In 1839, he published his account of the voyage, which was revised in 1845 and has remained in print ever since. He arranged and oversaw the publication under his joint editorship of the Zoology of the Voyage of HMS Beagle, consisting of 5 parts, in which hundreds and hundreds of new species were described. In 1842, he published a book on coral reefs, which was followed a couple of years later by one on the geology of volcanic islands visited by the Beagle, and a couple more years after that by one on the geology of South America itself. He also kept notebooks in which he wrote prolifically. And in one he noted that in October 1838, he happened to read for amusement, as he put it, the essay by Thomas Malthus on population. And it struck Darwin at once that the struggle for existence, which he had observed in plants and animals, must set up a competition whereby favourable variations are preserved and unfavourable ones destroyed, and that, to use his words again, the result of this would be the formation of new species. In another notebook, Darwin had already drawn a sketch like a branching tree, setting out how modern and separate groups of animals could be descended from a common ancestor. On 29th January 1839, Darwin had married his cousin, Emma Wedgwood, the daughter of his mother's brother and a close friend of Charles since childhood. After a brief stint living in London, they moved to Down House in Kent, an old vicarage set on 18 acres. Charles was already experiencing the stomach ailments and worse that would continue to plague him for the rest of his life. Darwin made several additions to Down House to accommodate their servants and his growing family. He and Emma would have 10 children of their own. Having completed the first round of renovations at Down House and his book on volcanoes, Darwin threw himself into expanding on his initial pencil sketch of his ideas for the transmutation of species. Evolution, by another name. And he completed a 230-page manuscript by July 1844. So there you had it, the basis for evolution by natural selection, all done and dusted 14 years before he would tell even the scientific world. In essence, his thoughts went like this: that all life is descended from common ancestors, that new species come about through a process of natural selection, that this results from there being too many individuals that can possibly survive and reproduce in an environment, which in turn sets up a struggle for existence a la Malthus, or, has become popularized when referring to Darwin's theory, a struggle for survival leading to survival of the fittest. Except that is both a struggle for survival and a struggle for reproduction, because it is through reproduction that those individuals with the variations that allow them to survive best in an environment will be the fittest. That is, they will be able to reproduce the most and pass on those favourable variations to their offspring. Conversely, those with unfavourable variations will be least able to survive and reproduce, and their line will not be preserved. His views of natural selection relies on there being, firstly, natural variation in the population for particular traits. Secondly, competition for survival and reproduction that results in individuals with favourable variations enjoying better reproductive success than others. And thirdly, some mechanism of inheritance that would ensure offspring inherited the favourable variations of their parents. This mechanism of inheritance would prove the stumbling block, which may have accounted for why Darwin did not climb to the top of the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral and announce to the world that they should abandon thoughts of a creator and think only in terms of a natural process. For such an unknown mechanism of inheritance aside, if finches could beget different types of finches, wasn't it an inescapable conclusion of his thinking that monkeys could beget men? Darwin sent the manuscript away to be copied, but he was a long way from being prepared to publish what he knew to be radical incendiary, if scientifically important, ideas. Instead, he wrote a letter to his wife. "My dear Emma, I have just finished my sketch of my species theory. If, as I believe, that my theory is true, and if it be accepted by even one competent judge, it will be a considerable step in science. I therefore write this in case of my sudden death, as my most solemn and last request, which I am sure you will consider the same as if legally entered in my will, that you will devote £400 to its publication." So Darwin clearly saw the academic merit in his idea. He was not backward in perceiving it to be the major scientific advance that it would become. But like some 19th century version of base jumping, he hesitated before taking the leap, unsure if professional exhilaration or annihilation lay before him. He did confide in his close friends, the geologist Charles Lyell, the botanist Joseph Hooker, and Leonard Jennings, the poor chap who had turned down the position of naturalist on the Beagle in his own opportunity for scientific immortality. But otherwise, Darwin kept silent. On 18th June 1858, Darwin received the shock of his life. Alfred Russel Wallace sent Darwin an essay written while he was recovering from malaria, contracted while collecting specimens in what is now Malaysia. Wallace had independently come up with the basis for evolution by natural selection. As Darwin put it to Lyell, "I never saw a more striking coincidence." This was not a particularly good time for Darwin, even without Wallace to contend with. His daughter Henrietta was very sick, possibly with diphtheria, and his youngest child, Charles, got scarlet fever and died a few days later. Preoccupied as he was with the grief for his son, Darwin was nevertheless devastated by the arrival of Wallace's manuscript, in a way that must have been similar to the feelings experienced by Scott a bit more than half a century later, when he should arrive at the South Pole only to find Amundsen's tent there before him. Darwin sent Hooker an abstract of the Wallace manuscript, plus a copy of his own manuscript that he had completed back in 1844. "I really cannot bear to look at it," Darwin wrote to Hooker. "Do not waste much time. It is miserable in me to care at all about priority." In fact, Hooker, along with Lyell, wasted very little time, convincing Darwin that he should prepare a joint paper with Wallace to be read at the next meeting of the Linnaean Society. In the wake of the Linnaean Society meeting, Darwin threw himself into writing his theory up fully, and in November 1859, his book was published with the rather grand title, "On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life." A mouthful, destined to be known by its first five words. The book has remained in print ever since. There were those that immediately saw the import of Darwin's words. Thomas Huxley, upon reading On the Origin of Species, famously remarked, "How extremely stupid not to have thought of that." But there was opposition too. Richard Owen, the young professor who had described the fossils Darwin had collected during the voyage of the Beagle, launched a bitter attack on Darwin's views in an anonymous article published in the Edinburgh Review. And Darwin should not have expected any less by way of reaction from the church. As with much that was to follow the publication of The Origin of Species, Darwin left it to others to fight his battles for him, content to observe the fray from the safety of Down House. One of the most famous battles took place in Oxford between the Bishop of Oxford, Samuel Wilberforce, otherwise known by the rather unlikely nickname for a man of the cloth as Soapy Sam, and Thomas Huxley. At a meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, Soapy Sam turned to Huxley and famously asked whether it was on his grandfather's or his grandmother's side that he was descended from an ape. The exact words that Huxley used to reply are a matter of conjecture, but the essence of it was that he would prefer an ape as an ancestor than a man who would squander his great intellect for the purpose of ridicule. Throughout all the controversy that raged outside, Darwin remained in Down House, where he continued to study and write books at a frenetic pace. These included one on orchids, another on climbing plants, two volumes on the domestication of plants and animals, The Descent of Man, one on emotions in animals and man, another couple on plants, their fertilization and movements, one on insectivorous plants, and finally one on worms. But issues remained with the fundamental theory of natural selection that underscored his life's output. For one thing, Darwin's proposed mechanism of inheritance, the means by which favored characteristics of animals and plants could be passed on to succeeding generations, was flawed. It would take Gregor Mendel, with his experiments on peas, and later Watson and Crick, to show us that fundamentally Darwin's concept of natural selection is correct, that traits, or variations, are heritable, and that this is a process controlled by the genes. Darwin died on 19th April 1882, following a period of vomiting and nausea, which had been his constant companions pretty much since he stepped off the Beagle, and if you include motion sickness, then you might well say pretty much since he stepped onto it too. There is an urban legend that Darwin somehow recanted his views on his deathbed and embraced the views of the church. Nothing could be further from the truth, according to his daughter, Henrietta, who was at his bedside. It is true that Darwin wished to be buried in the grounds of the little church in the village of Down, St. Mary the Virgin. But that was understandable. It was much more about staying close to his family than seeking to be closer to the church. His brother Erasmus had been buried there the year before. His wife would be buried there later, as would four of his children, including the hapless Charles, who had died of scarlet fever and been buried just as Darwin and Wallace were having their great discoveries read to the world at the meeting of the Linnaean Society. It was Darwin's scientific colleagues and the government of the day, not Darwin, who had insisted on marking his funeral with pomp and ceremony, befitting of his contribution to our understanding of the world. A week after he died, Darwin was laid to rest in Westminster Abbey. Among the pallbearers that day were Joseph Hooker, Thomas Huxley, and Alfred Russel Wallace. Emma Darwin had stayed in Down, preferring to mourn the loss of her beloved Charles in private. After his death, the deeply religious Emma discovered amongst Darwin's notes a letter she had written to him soon after they were married. Anxious should his wavering views on religion mean that they could not share the afterlife. She wrote, "Everything that concerns you concerns me, and I should be most unhappy if I thought we did not belong to each other forever." She found Darwin had appended to the letter these words, "When I am dead, know that many times I have kissed and cried over this." So Darwin in many ways was a romantic, a man always good with words. He demonstrated this when he wrote the final paragraph of The Origin of Species. Its first sentence is a masterpiece. "It is interesting to contemplate an entangled bank, clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other, and dependent on each other in so complex a manner, have all been produced by laws acting around us." It is a statement of elegant beauty, a metaphor for the world. The diversity of life all around us, Darwin was saying, is nothing less than a testimonial to the powers of natural selection. And what is this biodiversity that Darwin alluded to with his entangled bank, if it is not a snapshot of natural selection's changing face at a point in the history of the earth? At this point, however, in the history of the earth, natural selection has given rise to a single species that has the capacity to destroy the biodiversity and the biosphere, to do no less than destroy life on earth. And it is worth us remembering that Darwin's idea of evolution, that sketch first scribbled in a notebook not long after getting back on the Beagle, was of a branching tree, a bush, not a mountain. By implication, humans are but a twig on that bush, no more important than any of the other branches down which life has evolved, be it to barnacles or bristlecone pines. If we take nothing else from Darwin's great idea, it should be that we are not a pinnacle, that we are not at some evolutionary peak, that we should feel compelled to conquer other life forms like Hillary atop Everest. Now that's what I call an idea still worth caring about. Thank you.